Good morning. My name is King Solomon, but you can call me King Solomon, my Lord, His Highness. It's good to see all of you, and I noticed that you're not bowing down to me right now, and I understand. Please stay seated. You're not used to being in the presence of divine royalty, so I will not hold that against you. But in the future, please remember to bow down low. Thank you. I am also not offended by your sermon series. It's so endearing. The wisest fool. And it's true. I truly was the wisest, most wealthy, most powerful, most honorable king to have ever ruled the nation of Israel. But I was also a fool. See, the temptations of money, power, and sex eventually led to my ruin. Sure, I have some regrets and some things I wish I could have done differently. There were many warning signs early on in my reign that I should have paid more close attention to, but I didn't. Like many of you, I didn't heed any of those signs. But I'm thankful. At least I left the people of God some great material. Hundreds of Proverbs, maybe you've read them. A book of wisdom called Ecclesiastes, which I said, I talked about how I tried everything, did everything under the sun, and I found it all to be vanity, a chasing after the wind. The only thing that I realize is the most important thing is to know God. And of course, I've also left all of you a very romantic book, if you want to call it that, The Song of Solomon. Have you read it? You would know that I definitely knew women well if you read that book. And there's, of course, my life. And there's two things I hope that my life would point out to you. First, I hope that when you think about me, that my life would be a warning to you of how not to live and what not to do. But I also hope that my life would really be a signpost that would point you to someone much greater than I. But I'm getting ahead of myself now. And so many of you heard last week, if you were here, I was told that you learned about my great wisdom. And I was sacrificing to the Lord 1,000 burnt offerings at the high place at Mount Gibeon. And there I sacrificed over 1,000 burnt offerings to the Lord. It was a wonderful experience, an act of worship. It was very extravagant. I was so exhausted that I fell asleep at Gibeon. Gibeon was about 6 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And while asleep, the Lord appeared to me in a dream. Can you imagine God coming to you and asking you for one wish? And that's what he said. He said, Solomon, ask for whatever you want, and I will give it to you. Can you imagine the Lord asking you that very question? Well, he probably won't, because you would ask for wealth or power or whatever, a world peace. But what I asked for was something much different. I said, Lord, give your servant a discerning heart. Literally, in my native tongue, I asked for a listening heart so that I could distinguish between good and evil, so that I could lead God's people with wisdom. And that's exactly what the Lord gave me. And God, in His grace, gave me what I did not ask for: wealth, power, honor, and a long life. I just love that about the Lord. He is truly a generous God. And so what does any king do when he gets this type of wisdom? Well, I threw a party. I went back to Jerusalem, the city of David, the city of my father, and I sacrificed more burnt offerings before the Ark of God's covenant. And after that sacrifice, I threw a feast for all of my court. It was a glorious feast. We danced. We praised God. We ate wonderful food. And it happened through the night. It was truly a glorious, glorious day. God was once and finally with his people again. God was with me, his chosen leader for the nation of Israel. Well, unfortunately, that wisdom would be put to the test immediately in the form of a custody battle over the custody of a child, a small young boy. And people at that time wondered, did I really have the wisdom that I needed to lead the nation of Israel? Well, that wisdom was put to the test. Have you ever been to a divine hall of justice, to a royal court like mine? Probably not. But it was a glorious, glorious hall of justice. On the outside of my court, we only use the choicest of stone. And we cut each stone by hand, and we smoothed both the outside and the inside of each stone and placed it carefully into place. And we built the structure a little bit smaller than this room. And then, of course, I hired only the best artisans and craftsmen, and a whole army of them went to work at building my hall of justice. One of my favorite men, my craftsman of bronze, was such an amazing artist. He set to work at the pillars, much like that pillar right there, made out of pure bronze. He then created, on top of each pillar, connecting them all together, a network of interwoven bronze chains. And then he knew that my favorite fruit was the pomegranate. And so he began to make many, many ornate pomegranates that filled the courthouse. And of course, he made the stands that we would need, and the tables and the chairs and the various things we would need from our room. But oh, I forgot to mention about the wood. Only the best wood would work. And so we got cedar from the forest of Lebanon. I absolutely love the smell of freshly cut cedar wood. And cedar from Lebanon covered the floor and the ceiling of my royal hall of justice. It was a marvelous place. And oh, my throne. Well, my throne. It was truly the greatest throne that the world has ever seen. It was made out of gold plated. It was gorgeous, inlaid in each area of the throne with precious stones, rubies, sapphires, emeralds. Now, let me be honest, it wasn't the most comfortable throne to sit on, but it was glorious, fantastic. I wish you could see a picture of my throne. And so the courthouse, the Hall of Justice, was completed. I was so pleased at the work that my craftsmen did that I sent them to work on the temple. And I also sent them to work on my palace, which took many, many years to build my glorious palace. Now, I say all this not to brag. Please don't hear that. I say this so that you could understand the beauty and the excellence and the painstakingly hard work that it took to build structures to honor God. Because people would come from all over the world to see and hear from my wisdom, but to see these structures. And I wanted them to honor the Lord. And that's what I set out to do. It was a long process, but a glorious one. My wisdom knew no bounds, and the structures were evidences of that. So here's what happened in my hall of justice that day. I was sitting in my glorious throne, and my guards bring in two women, two harlots of the night, well, two prostitutes. And you need to understand that as the chosen leader for all of Israel, I was the fountain of justice, of administration. There was no Supreme Court. I was the Supreme Court. There was no commander in chief. I was the commander in chief. And so whatever decree I laid down was not only law, it was as if the very words of God were being spoken. And so these two prostitutes were brought in, and they bowed low before me, as they should. Now you must understand that, much to my shame, prostitution was tolerated by us Israelites. And even though the Mosaic law forbade it, and it was prohibited, but we tolerated it. See, please remember that I inherited a kingdom that needed reform. We were still worshiping at the high places. The temple was not yet built. Sin was running rampant. And so there were two prostitutes in front of the king, in front of myself. And here's what happened that day. The first woman, she was on my left, bowed low to the ground, trembling with fear, tears streaming through her eyes. She knew the power that I had. And she cried out to me. She said, "My Lord," I always love when people address me like that. She said, "My Lord, pardon me and please hear me. This woman and I, we live in the same house. And I had a baby. He was a beautiful boy. And only 3 days later, she also had a baby boy. And we lived alone. And during the night, this woman," she pointed at her, "this woman lay on her baby. And he died. And she got up, my Lord, and in the middle of the night, she quietly and secretly put her dead baby on my breast and took my living baby and put it on her breast. And so I woke up in the morning and I was horrified. I thought my baby was dead. But as the sun came through our little window, I noticed that this baby was not mine. It was hers. She switched our babies, my Lord." And at that moment, this woman, this other harlot, screams out, "No, the living baby is mine. The dead one is yours." And then this woman again yelled back to her, "No, the dead one is yours. The living one is mine." And they began to argue in front of the king. It's hard to appreciate what was at stake for these women. See, you need to understand that there was no evidence to corroborate either's testimony. There was no witnesses as well. If there was evidence or witnesses, the normal due process would have taken place and this would have never came to me. But it came to me because much was at stake. See, you need to understand, and your culture does not really get this, that family was everything. There was no social security or retirement accounts for these women to fall back on. They needed a boy. They needed a boy to take care of them once they got old. And without an heir, without a son, they would be destitute. Women and orphans in my day and age were considered lower than the low. They were forsaken and abandoned, thrown out as societal garbage. And that's why in my kingdom, I tried as I could to reform and do my best to take care of widows and orphans, but I'm sure many slip through the cracks. See, without this son, one of these women would truly face a fate that no one would want to go through. So much was at stake here. In fact, you should also know that the Mosaic law tells us that if you're guilty of kidnapping, you will be put to death by the sword. So if this was true, then the woman who stole this baby would be put to death. So what was I to do? What would you do? If you have all the power in the world, maybe you would just killed all three of them. Or maybe just killed one of the women and say, "Hey, give the baby to the other woman." Or maybe you would have said, "Just get out of my courthouse, I don't care." What would you have done? Well, at that moment of their arguing, this is what I said. "Silence! Stop arguing in front of the king. You say the living son is yours and the dead one is hers. You say, no, the dead one is hers and the living one is yours. I'm tired of it. What should I do with the both of you?" And it was at that moment, to be honest, I can get pretty excited, that I calmed myself down and I prayed a simple prayer. Have you ever prayed with your eyes wide open before? Sometimes in my life, and maybe in yours, it seems that the Lord is the only one who knows the truth. And this was truly one of those instances. And so with my eyes wide open, I prayed this prayer. I said, "My Lord, you are God. Please continue to give your servant a listening heart so that I can discern between right and wrong and between good and evil, because these are your people, Lord. I need you now." And an amazing thing happened in my heart and in my mind. The Lord gave me insight into a mother's psyche that I had previously not known about. And I knew what to do. See, it's deeply satisfying to find a simple solution to a difficult dilemma. And so once I knew what the Lord wanted me to do, because I heard his still, quiet voice, this is what I said next. "Bring me a sword." And you see how quiet it is in this room? That's about how quiet it was then. These two women began to shake uncontrollably. They began to weep even louder. And I looked at my attendants and I said, "Bring me a sword now. A king should never have to ask twice." And so my attendants, they brought me a sword. And I sat there and I just looked at both of these women. My courthouse, you should have seen their eyes. They were all just speaking quietly to themselves, nervous, not knowing what I would do with this sword. You should know that the sword has dominated kingdoms. Most kings before me and after me, they used the sword in service of their ruthless selves. Nations have been conquered by the sword, and nations have come to ruin by the sword. Everyone in that courthouse knew that I could instantly kill both women for their sin, for their stupidity. But I did something different. I took my sharpening rock, and I began just to sharpen the sword in front of everybody. Oh, the tension and the fear in the room was thicker than my mother Bathsheba's gravy. And once my sword was nice and sharp, I took, of course, my favorite fruit, a pomegranate, and I set it there. And just for the sake of drama, I cut the pomegranate right in half. Wiped off the juice. And this is what I said next. "Cut the living baby in two. Give half to her and half to her." And at that moment, a shriek was heard in my courthouse. My entire court just gasped in horror. Would I really do that? And yes, I would. And at that moment, the woman on my left screamed out, "No, no, please, my Lord, do not hurt the child. Please, just give him to her." Ah, there it was. See, her maternal instincts took over. See, she had bonded deeply with this child. She cared for this child for several days. She loved this child so much that she's willing to sacrifice and give this child to her enemy instead of seeing this child cut in two. See, it always amazes me the love and the selflessness and the sacrifices that women and mothers go through for their children. And it happens for fathers and as well. Mothers and fathers, as you know, continually don't do what they want to do because they want to do for their child. They continually do acts of selfless service for the sake of their children. And see, this mother would rather this baby be alive and be given to some other woman than to see this baby dead. Compassion and passion just came out of her. Well, you've read the story. The other mother had quite a different reaction. In anger and with just such vile words, she yelled out, "Cut the child in two, I'll take my half." I was horrified. Anger and grief had captivated her heart. If she could not have the child, then no one was going to have the child alive. See, hurting people hurt people. Broken people break people. And I began to have compassion for her, though. Can you imagine what it must be like to accidentally kill your own child? I can't. And so it was at this moment, with the hearts of both women revealed, that I gave my next decree. And I said, "Give the living child to this woman, for she is his rightful mother. Do not harm him. Do not cut him. Give him to this child." And with just tears of joy, she embraced that baby boy and kissed him all over. She was so grateful and so thankful for my mercy. Well, the Torah, the Old Testament in your Bible tells us that children are a gift from the Lord no matter how they're conceived. And I was, with joy, I was delighted to give this child back to the rightful mother. Now, many have asked me, and many of you have wondered, well, what happened to the other mother? Well, I sent them both out of the room, and I simply said this: "Both of you, stop living in your sinful ways. Get out of my court. I don't want to see you again. If I do, you'll both be put to death. Leave now." And they were escorted out of my presence. Well, as you can imagine, news like this travels quickly. My entire courtroom, once these women left, were stunned in silence. And a deep sense of awe fell over them. And news traveled like wildfire. And all of Jerusalem held me in awe. They truly understood for the first time. And they truly knew that God had given me wisdom, His wisdom, to rule and reign over His people. And see, the mark of a truly great leader is not how many degrees they have. It's not where they've been to school or what their title is or how much money they make. The mark of a truly great leader is a leader who possesses a wise and discerning heart. And the wisdom that I needed for this case was truly only, it could only be given by God Himself. No one knew what to do except for the Lord. And so the nation of Israel celebrated. They had finally came to the realization that God was with us once again. That I truly was the wisest leader to have ever led them. And so I set about for the rest of my building projects, which you'll hear about, I've heard, in weeks to come. Now, I'm sure that some of you are sitting there and you're wondering, well, that's a great story, King, but what does it have to do with me? That's a great question. Are any of you surprised that two prostitutes got an audience with the king? You should be. As I've already said, the Mosaic law forbid the practice. And as you are well aware, that I wrote the Proverbs, hundreds of them, and in many of them, I warn young men especially to stay clear away from the house of a prostitute for obvious reasons. So how in the world do two sinful women and their sinful practices get an audience with God's chosen leader? Well, it's very clear to me, and I hope it becomes clear to you. I cared for these women and their illegitimate child. Why? Because God cares for these prostitutes and their illegitimate child. See, I shouldn't have to tell you, church people, that the church should stand for moral holiness and authority and for righteousness. You get that, I'm sure. But shouldn't the church also be a place of forgiveness and restoration and reconciliation and love? I think it should. And so I cared for these women and this child because God cared for these women and this child. I showed them the love and compassion that God has for them. See, I'm so delighted that you are studying my life. I'm very flattered. Trust me, please believe that. But really, my life should point you to someone much, much greater than I. My life should point you to the rightful King, the true King, the Lord Jesus Christ. He is the King of kings. He is the Lord of lords. His wisdom is much, much grander than my own. And if you've ever read about his life, I'm sure you've read that he also cared for broken sinners and even, yes, prostitutes. Didn't he? See, it's in Jesus that God provided a simple but costly solution to the greatest problem that the world had ever seen, the problem of our own sin. How could a just and holy God have a relationship with guilty sinners like you and like me? And so he sent his one and only Son into this world, the God-man, Jesus Christ. And upon that cross, he would take the sins of the world upon him. Every evil that you have done was laid upon him on that cross. Really, the sword of divine justice crushed his body. And as he bled for us and for you and for me, why? So that we can receive the mercy of God. Just like these prostitutes did. See, here's the good news. If God has mercy for prostitutes, he has mercy for us. See, every life matters to God. You are not worthless. He loves you. He's crazy about you. And even though he's created you and knows every vile thing you have done, he still invites you to come to his Son Jesus, to trust him with your life. See, without him, there is no hope. There is no forgiveness. Here I am, the wisest and richest and most powerful man that have ever lived, but I lived on the other side of the cross. And my heart became divided as I chased many, many foreign women, and it led to my downfall. And so please hear me as I close. Every life matters to God. The cross is the best solution for the worst problem of all. You're not worthless. You're not alone. He knows you by name. He loves you. Would you come to know him this morning? Because he truly is much, much greater than I. He hears your prayers. He answers you. And he loves giving wisdom for all who seek him. Shalom.